belonging is a very big thing for me personally, but I think for a lot of people. And I think when you have no sense of belonging, it's a lot harder to be brave and to embrace change. But when you have one set place of belonging, I think it's a little bit easier to sort of appear fearless in the other areas of your life.
Thanks for listening. This is U-Turns, where we talk about all things transformational, big changes, little changes, fun changes, and such. Because shift happens. I'm Lisa Oz.
And I'm Jill Herzig.
And today we are talking to our best friend, mine and Jill's best friend.
Yeah, who just so happens to be kind of an expert on change. We're talking with Jennifer Rudolph Walsh. I'm going to give you her official title here. She's the head of literary lectures and conferences at William Morris Endeavor. In other words, she's a BFD, big deal. She's really one of the most influential literary agents working today in the world. Her clients have included Oprah, Arianna Huffington, Sheryl Sandberg. The list goes on. It's longer than my arms.
Lisa Oz,
yes. And she's shaking up the conference world as well now with some of those same people, and has her own conference that she masterfully directs called Together Live. So we're here to talk about telling your story. That's what happens at Together Live. And I guess that's what life is all about.
Well, right? I agree. Well, first of all, hi, you guys.
Hi.
So you're two of my favorite people in the whole world. And I'm so thrilled to be sitting here talking about transformation. And we've had these conversations many, many times in restaurants and in kitchens and living rooms. So it's so fun to share it with everybody that's listening.
Yeah. Okay. I want to dive right into it because, as we have talked about in those kitchens and on bar stools, U-turns, they happen. I'm going through one right now, trying to figure out the career thing. Lisa's going through one. And, you know, one of the things that I've seen in your life is that you just so gracefully go through major changes.
Well, you make it look like it was planned.
I question the graceful part, but certainly I feel like I've made a good friend of change, and it's something that I never thought I would make friends with. And as somebody who, and all three of us share this, I met my husband when I was very young, and I've been in I've been in the same town my whole life. I was somebody who just thought, I don't want change. I'm going to have one job, and I'm going to do it one way, and then life happened. So I feel like I just learned to love change or else be unhappy all the time. And so,
do you feel like having some stability in some area of your life allows you the freedom to kind of explore in other areas of your life?
No question. I mean, when you have a bedrock, like we all do, of just a really strong partnership and family who loves you and who knows you and really accepts you for who you are, it gives you, I think, that opportunity to be brave in ways that doesn't feel as brave because you know you're going home to people who are going to be there to, you know, wipe you off if you need wiping off and hug you and make you feel like you belong.
There's like a mass to cling to.
Totally.
You.
Yeah. Well, I mean, belonging is a very big thing for me personally, but I think for a lot of people. And I think when you have no sense of belonging, it's a lot harder to be brave and to embrace change. But when you have one set place of belonging, I think it's a little bit easier to sort of appear fearless in the other areas of your life.
Do you get to kind of just fall apart in a heap sometimes when you get home?
Oh, I certainly could, but I don't think I'm the kind of person who, I'm not a fall aparter.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I'm more, I'm somebody who, and actually both of you are this way too, who lives a very purpose-driven life. And, you know, what I love about purpose is it's not something that can pass you by. It's not something that you can be fired from or you can retire from. It's something that is, you know, literally your reason for being here, through my lens anyway.
How did you figure out what your purpose
was?
Well,
I mean, I think it's been a process for me, but I feel like purpose is so essential to who you are that without knowing your Lisa's exact purpose, I could come up with some pretty clear breadcrumbs that would point to a clear sentence of your purpose. And certainly the same is true of you, Jill. And so what I love about the idea of purpose is that it's an evolving process. So my purpose I've come to understand is really about shining the light forward so others feel less alone, connected, elevated, and healed. And so I've done that. I've been doing that since I was a little girl. I didn't call it that, but I know that when I was making people feel heard and seen and reflecting back to them their own stories or their own strength, I felt really powerful. And I felt like time was, you know, was flowing by without my even noticing it. And when I was finished with one of these experiences, even as a child, I felt energized. So these are all, I think, what I call breadcrumbs that make you realize that all along your life's been kind of pointing you to purpose. And so for me, once I made the clear shift to living like a very clear purpose life, a lot of the other stuff fell away. And then I felt braver to take chances, felt braver to create a conference division or to, you know, or to create something that was not in the wheelhouse of what I'd always traditionally done.
Yeah. And your story sort of led you to that, kind of looking back at all those sort of twists and turns. You were able to pull out a story that led you to that sense of purpose.
Right. Well, I mean, I will say that...
Tell that story a little bit.
I will, but I'll also say for the longest time, I didn't think I had a story. So I am a literary agent. I know, but I just, you know, I didn't have any headline.
I think most of us didn't lose a parent, thank God.
I mean, I didn't recover from an illness. I wasn't living on the streets. And so I've been this pilot light for other people's stories, this midwife for other people's stories. And I love that. And that's incredibly energizing for me. But I think that I didn't realize that inside all those stories were something that I was responding to in my own life. It's almost like all those stories was my story in 1,000 different volumes. Mm-hmm. And I came to realize over the last 10 years, really, and I'm 51 years old, so it took me really until I was in my 40s mm-hmm. to realize, oh, I have a story too. And it's not glass castle. I didn't, mm-hmm. you know, and I didn't live on the streets and have to eat from a dumpster. And thank God for the glass castle because that taught me about resilience.
Yeah.
And
so you're talking about Jeanette Walls.
Jeanette Walls's book.
Yeah.
So I feel like what I realize is that I have a story and it's an important story and that everybody has a story and everybody's story matters. So now to go back to my story, I was not the typical student with the face in the book, quite the opposite. I was kicked out of middle school. I was kicked out of high school. And in fact, I was kicked out of high school, presumably because I'd failed to go to class enough times. But really, truly, what the headmaster said to my mother, it was my second semester of my sophomore year, they said, not one teacher here will recommend Jennifer for college. Not one. And so we want her to go to a school where there'll at least be one person who's willing to recommend her. And so to be told when you're 16 or 17 years old that you would fail to distinguish yourself to the point where not one single person would recommend me— it was a very bitter pill to swallow, and I certainly wanted to be better, but I didn't even know how. Like, I didn't, so opposite, you know, Jill, of somebody who's so, you're so studious, you're such a good student, and I looked at people like you, and I thought, how do they do that? How do they connect the dots? And a joke that I've made for years is that my nighttime self and my morning self are sworn enemies.
So I don't think you're alone there.
Yeah, so it's like at night, I would just want to do all the work that I knew I needed to do, but I also wanted to talk on the phone and be with my friends or do whatever.
Yeah.
And then I would wake up in the morning and I would just be like, oh, damn you, nighttime Jennifer. And I have a similar version now with food and alcohol.
And you were like, you were getting people's stories.
I was doing my thing.
Yeah,
I was
doing my thing. That's what you were doing. Yeah. And so, big struggle.
Big struggle. And then I finally
Nobody wrote in your yearbook, destined to be one of the world's great literary agents,
no,
huh?
There was no greatness that I was destined for. Or so that's what I felt and that's what I was told. And then I eventually found my way to a high school, and I'm not going to take us year by year, but I found a headmistress there who really got me and got that I had something very special. And she made a deal with me, and she said, if you come to school every day, I'll give you $1 every day. And then I will recommend you to a good liberal arts college where I think you can thrive. And so she kept her end of the bargain. And which was awesome,
like $100,
a dollar a day. I mean, it was literally like enough to buy pizza and soda pretty much every day.
Yeah.
And then she kept her end of the bargain, and she recommended me to Kenyon College, and I went there. And it was there that for the first time I ever like discovered contemporary voices in fiction. I thought all authors were like dead white dudes.
Yeah,
I had no idea.
One would think that.
Yeah. So I mean, suddenly I'm reading, you know, Toni Morrison and Maya Angelou, and I'm just. I cannot believe that I'm reading, you know, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and I'm hearing my own life experience, even though I have nothing in common with this woman growing up in the segregated South.
Yeah.
And yet I feel this desire for love, and will I ever become who I'm meant to be, and will I find my voice, and will I make a difference?
Yeah.
And so that was when I realized
suddenly that you also find the desire to write a paper.
Exactly.
Which you may never have felt in your entire life.
Totally.
Yeah.
So that it was that kind of igniting of, you know, what I would say is like the early days of my calling. I knew I wanted to be as close to storytelling and to like the amplification of people's stories as humanly possible.
Do you not want to write your own book?
I mean, it's not a real desire of mine. It's something that people have obviously brought up to me a lot.
Because you have so many good stories.
Well, I think my stories are really everybody else's stories. And sometimes I think that I would just want to write that, like everybody else's stories and how they've affected me. So I don't know. Hmm. Maybe one day.
Could be the next U-turn.
I don't know. Could be the next U-turn. I mean, to be honest with you, I just feel so bad for writers because they have to sit by themselves and write all day long. And I just love to interact. So, but I'm open. I'm honestly open to anything.
Yeah.
I really am.
Yeah. And so you really and truly believe that everybody has an incredible story.
Every single person. If you have breath, you have two things, a purpose and an incredible story to share that matters.
Okay. That fills my heart. We're going to take a quick break. Before the break, we were talking about stories and how you believe, Jennifer, that everybody has a story. And is everyone's story part of the great universal story?
I believe that. And let me just, before we get 5,000 emails saying, like, will you read my story? It's not the same thing as saying everybody's story should be published.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay? Everybody's not a writer. And as I've said, question mark as to whether I could be one day. But everybody has a story that needs to be shared. And I do believe is part of sort of the universal narrative, the collective of what it means to be human.
And we're not just a jumble of lots of different stories. There's one main through line that you would
I believe
say
there's
you
one
gotta,
main,
it's the monomyth.
Yeah, I believe there's one main through line. And, but that doesn't mean that it's a black and white through line.
Okay.
You know, everybody has a story of sort of becoming who they were meant to be and of the obstacles that stood in the way and of the heartbreak and of the triumph and of the misunderstandings.
And we're obviously living it now as we reflect on it at the same time.
Right. And why does it matter? Like, it matters because when you hear somebody else's story and you find just even the smallest part of yourself in it or your sister in it, or your friend, you just realize that we're really more alike than we are different, and that we're in it together. I mean, we're really truly in this together, and we're wired for it. We're wired for needing each other and for a desire for a sense of belonging. And I think that nothing like storytelling brings you to that moment, you know, more quickly and more instantly than that moment when you're shaking your head upside down, up and down, and you go, "Oh my God, me too!" Like I thought I was the only one.
Yeah.
In fact, we almost called together live, "Me too." 3 years before the Me Too movement. I'm glad we didn't.
Yeah.
But the impulse was the same.
Yeah.
Me too.
Certainly. You know, it's funny. My sister and I are very different people, my older sister and I.
Yeah, you sure are.
And you know that. And, you know, one of the things I think we've come to realize in the past few years is just to really value the fact that our starter story, anyway, is the same.
Like yeah.
There's so much of the same plot line, and she's kind of the only, whether we're part of the universal story or not, there's a particular Herzig plot line.
That's right. And she's the only person.
It's a little weird, and we've lived it together.
Yeah, she's the only person, other than your parents, that were there the day you were born, the day you came home, she was there.
Yeah.
Same with your sister,
my
sister, right?
Next to my mother in the taxi cab and almost helped her give birth to me right there and then.
There's something so powerful about that.
Yeah.
And I mean, even just in the, you know, in our 10 plus years and in our 20 plus years of knowing each other, what I've come to kind of feel is that continuity of love and relationships, bearing witness to your lives over those years and having you bear witness to mine, like that's the closest thing to a real religion I feel like I have, is that it's that religion of connection and continuity through time. It's just an amazing privilege to bear witness to your lives and to have my life be seen through those eyes. And, you know, each of you will remember something that I've forgotten and say, "Oh, remember that time you said that?" You especially, Jill. Jill's the memory.
I don't think so, but maybe.
But it's such a beautiful thing. And you know, now, for example, I'm the moderator of Together Live. But Lisa could remember a time when I would just say to you, how do you go out on stage like that? You're so natural. You never worry about anything. I was so full of stage fright that I couldn't even think that I could stand on a stage.
Yeah. So what did you do? Because we've actually been talking to a number of different people who are also now mega speakers. And a bunch of them have said that they struggled with it.
What are the steps to overcoming that fear?
Well, I don't have steps,
fear.
And I'm hardly a mega speaker.
I'm hardly
a mega speaker. In fact, I don't have an interest in being a mega speaker.
But you do it.
I'm the audience stand-in, and that's how I found my way. Like, for me, and again, this is my lens, and I don't mean to sound like some kind of evangelist, but since it's always about purpose, it's like, how am I serving the purpose in this? Where's the act of service? And if I can find the act of service, I can literally do anything. I could stand on the corner with a sandwich board and give out flyers.
And in truth, what you're doing at the conference is you're pulling stories out of people.
Yeah, and I'm
setting
the audience,
them up and asking them that extra little question that pushes them deeper. So
that's right.
It's your purpose. It's
my
purpose.
That's right. And so, and I'm also feeling like I'm showing the audience that you don't have to be, you know, a thought leader to be standing on the stage, that there's no difference between the stage and the audience. And I'm highlighting stories that I feel, rather than hero worship, to use your phrase, are more about, can you find yourself in this story? And can you find inspiration? And can you find direction? Instead of somebody sitting up there and telling you what you should do and how you should do it, just instead sort of sharing their wild-hearted experiences and you find yourself in them. And so I call myself a great thought follower instead of a thought leader. In fact, I'm a leading thought follower. And I'm up there sort of on behalf of the audience in that sense, following the thoughts.
Yeah, and sort of inviting them up there with you.
Yeah.
What were the biggest thoughts, the ones that had the most impact on you? Because you are, you know, one of the most powerful literary agents in the world, and the books you choose, because you always say you're not going to take a book that doesn't fit into your mission, right?
Right.
So you're not going to, just because it's going to sell well, you have no interest
right.
in helping it. So they have to speak to you.
Right.
What are the big themes that have really resonated for you over the course of, you know, 20 years?
Well, I would say that finding your voice, having the courage to be vulnerable, checking the story that you're telling yourself. These are some of the narratives that have been most powerful to me. Brené Brown, mm-hmm. obviously Oprah Winfrey, Alice Munro, Sue Monk Kidd. I mean, these incredible people, Arianna Huffington, who are bringing self-care to a place of self-revelation for me. And it could be through fiction or nonfiction.
Right.
But it has to really feel authentic, and it has to feel not necessarily completely original, but in its presentation completely original. I mean, it could be derivative, it could be standing on the shoulders of giants, but it has to feel like when I'm coming to this work, I feel like it's completely new to me. And when I finish it, I feel less alone, elevated, connected, and healed.
Those are good things.
Yeah, those are all good things.
Expand a little on the idea of checking the story that you're telling yourself.
Well, this is a profound Brené Brown kind of thought, which is that a lot of times we fill in silence with a story. You know, so Lisa didn't call me back. We had lunch. I thought it went great. But at the very end of the lunch, she seemed a little distracted. And then I called her a few days later, and she didn't return my phone call. So now, this is a completely fictional story.
It was the other way around. She didn't return my phone call.
First of all, this would never happen, because I would call Lisa 13 times until she returned my call, because I love her so much. But so let's just say she didn't return my phone call, and now I'm focusing on the way that she seemed a little distracted at the very end of the lunch. And I'm thinking, did I talk about myself too much? Was I bragging? Was I too self-obsessed? And now I'm starting to imagine that she's really angry with me, and she doesn't want to get together with me anymore. And I'm creating a whole story around this silence between us. Whereas, as Brené says, if I just check the story, send her a little note, hey, Lisa, you seem pretty distracted at the end of our lunch, and then I called you, and you haven't called me back, so I just want to make sure that everything's okay. And then she gets back to me, oh, my God, of course, I was distracted because I got a note that my son had a fever, and it's been three horrible days, and I've been dealing with, you know, this thing, and oh, my God, no, loved lunch, love you, goodbye, end of story. So checking the story and having the sort of vulnerability to say, I'm feeling a little weird, rather than just now building this whole thing where the next time I see Lisa, I'm acting weird because I think she's acting weird.
Right.
And
do you do that, though? Do you
I check the story now.
No, but did you make those stories in your head? Were you that
course.
Type of person?
Everybody's that type
not
of person.
Not everybody. No, no, no. My husband is not that type of person.
Okay.
No, I know
a lot
of people
is odd in a number of ways. He's kind of
exceptional. Also, maybe it's more female. Like, I can speak to the female experience better.
Because I totally do that. And he thinks I'm just paranoid.
No, well, you
I
are paranoid. even a broken clock is right twice a day. No, but everybody does it to a certain extent. And I guarantee you that the silence, and again, I'm following these thoughts, okay? This is Brené Brown's work, but I guarantee you that the story that you're telling yourself is never a happy story. It's never a positive story. And for me, I would say one of the biggest U-turns that I've made in my life, and that's these last years of my life have been about really recognizing the negative self-talk. Like, whoa. I mean, from the minute I wake up in the morning, I was at myself about every what I didn't do, what I forgot, you know, what I spoke too opinionated about, what I ate, what I drank. I mean, you name it. I would just be at myself first thing in the morning. And when I had the great, glorious honor of going on tour with Oprah Winfrey for the Life You Want tour, she actually talked about it from the stage and just said how before she even opens up her eyes in the morning, she forces herself to say thank you to herself for at least three things. And nobody ever talked to me about that. Like, I didn't, frankly, I thought the negative self-talk was part of my success. Like, I'm so damn straight with myself.
And it's hard sometimes to let it go because you think, if I don't berate myself,
who will?
Then how will I jump through and over all the bars?
Right. And I'll tell you, the answer is with incredible love.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that self-care piece is so huge for me because, I mean, I'm not going to break 45 years of habits overnight, but I can say that I really don't do that anymore. And in fact, when I find myself kind of doing the beration, you know, berating myself for things, I joke around with myself, and I this is going to sound so funny and your audience is going to be rolling their eyes, but I call myself sweetheart. I try to talk to myself as if I was talking to you or you. I try to treat myself with the same basic decency that I would give to my Uber driver.
Yeah.
Instead of treating myself like somebody who just killed a bunch of kids, you know?
Do you find that maybe that's a function of age, though? And that I find that as I get older, I was always a very judgmental person. I'm not unjudgmental now, but I find that I let things go more easily with myself and with other people. It's like I'm not so quick to...
Well, they're totally related, by the way.
Yeah.
They're totally related. The easier you are on yourself, the easier you find yourself being on others.
Does it work the other way around, too?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so if you're... Yeah. Just letting other people slide, you won't have to beat yourself up all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it helps the other way around, but really it's best when it comes from the way you treat yourself.
Yeah.
But I feel like definitely it comes from age. I mean, my grandfather used to say that your 50s were the decade of great reward for those who did the work in their 30s and 40s. Hmm. And, you know, 1 year in, I can say I really feel that way from an emotional perspective.
He sounds like a very evolved grandfather.
Oh, he's the greatest. Oh. Grandpa Rudy.
Grandpa Rudy.
Bless
but
you.
Anyway, I feel that way. I feel just so much joy in the moment of... You know, as I was saying, the religion of just like love and continuity over time. And I see it everywhere. Like I feel it not just with my dear friends and my family and my colleagues and the authors I represent and the people that I go on tour with, but even people that you're incidentally like you know over years, friends of your friends. Like and you realize, oh, wow, you know, I don't really think of you as a friend, but I've known you for 20 years or I've known you. And I just get a real kick out of that. Like, I just love that.
It's interesting. I live in Brooklyn. I'm smushed together with people all the time. I am on the subway multiple times most days. And I have to say, I have found that during this period of kind of trying to figure out my future, my job situation, that I am much more tolerant of other people people talk to me much more easily now. Maybe I just look like that crazy lady on the subway who anyone can talk to. But I just, that flashpoint that, you know, I'm not so trigger happy with my judgments or pulling away from people. There's like a softening, a weird softening.
I love that. I mean, I call that
found.
Growth at the speed of pain, right? I mean, but I love it. I want to be strong back, soft heart, again, as Brené Brown says.
Yeah.
I want that. And so I know when you're the busiest person in the room and you have to get someplace with so much intentionality, you don't make eye contact with people and you don't stop to listen to somebody else's story. And I mean, you guys know me, so you know I'm always looking for signs from the universe, right? So think about all the signs I've missed because I've been so determined to get from point A to point B. as opposed to just sort of being where I was and seeing like what the universe was leaving for me. And so I feel that way too. I mean, I'm not in quite the same transition as you, but I feel like I am in a constant transition, yeah. a constant process of becoming.
Yeah.
And the more I open myself to other people's experiences and the more I like don't let myself be quick to judgment, the more I find myself in people's stories and the more I learn about myself and the more compassion I feel.
Yeah.
It's like, wow. I mean, I've
kind of opens you up.
It really does. Like, I've been thinking for a long time about how I love to sort of say that I was like the tough love queen. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I've been thinking about that a lot. Like, tough love, like, does it?
You're just really honest.
I am really honest.
It's never, tough love has the implication that it's a little mean. And you're never mean.
Thank you.
You're just very direct. And people need to hear that because, you know, we have tons of BS floating around in our brains. And you have a way of just being very incisive and saying, nope, that's not what the situation is. This
I
is
appreciate
the situation.
That.
No, it's true.
I appreciate that because one of the things I've
been
thinking
is supportive in a different way.
Because I feel like love should only hurt. I think the truth only hurts when it's meant to.
Like, yeah, your intention is always pure.
So I never want that. And I've just been thinking about, well, how do you say things differently so that it doesn't feel like a slap in the face? And again, this is all about, you know, going with the flow of your own life and how it sort of, it makes you more empathetic for people who are going through whatever struggle they're going through.
Yeah, I mean, and I actually don't want to lose that piece of it. I would like to move out of this transition at some point, but I don't want to lose that transitional feeling of openness and, hey, whatever.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, I mean, you're in control
okay.
of that.
Yeah.
You know, that's something that you could just make that something you're not going to let go of.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's an openness that when you are on the top of your next mountain, and you certainly will be without any question about it, you're going to make an intention to yourself that no matter what, you're going to remember what that openness feels like and make sure that that door just remains permanently opened.
Yeah.
And by the way, it'll make you, I think, a much more effective leader in whatever it is that you, wherever you're leading next.
So let's get back to the idea of purpose a little bit, because I have to say that sounds very monumental to me. It sounds big.
Right.
Like, you know, purpose is righting wrongs in this world.
Right.
Purpose is social justice.
Well, if that's your purpose, then it is. My purpose is not social justice.
Right.
So
right.
Purpose is, in my opinion, you know, I think it was Mark Twain.
Can it be small?
Yeah,
it could be small.
Small in the way the words sound, but it's never small in what it's meant to do for the world. In my interpretation of purpose, Mark Twain says, two most important days are the day you're born and the day you find out why. Which I love that because I think, you know, for me, I always wanted my purpose to be like some hidden talent. Like, oh my God, she's an unbelievable folk art painter. And we never knew. Like, oh my God. You know, unfortunately, I never found my hidden talent because a hidden talent is not purpose.
Do you have popsicle stick sculptures hidden under your bed?
I always kind of hoped that,
literally,
they would be like, hey, has anybody know how to use this, you know, this one pot cooker? And it would be like, wow, it ends up mom's amazing at that. Like, you
can
know.
Can your purpose change, though?
Yeah,
do you think
it evolves.
Into something entirely different, maybe?
Well, I would say the form looks entirely
okay.
different.
Okay.
But the purpose is always the same. So again, we could have 2 hours just on Lisa Oz's purpose. But you're somebody for whom, like, speaking truth to power is an incredibly powerful part of the way that you function in the world. It's like you have this unbelievable amount of knowledge. I mean, you teach me more than almost anybody else I know. And then you have this very brave way of expressing whatever that truth is, right? So my guess is that if we dug to get to your sentence, that part of it would involve sharing truth. Like, I don't have all the pieces, but the point is it doesn't matter if you're on a podcast or if you're writing books or if you're on a speaking tour, your purpose is still going to be the essence of the truth telling that's the same for you. And the form, you know, can change to some things we haven't even been invented yet.
So if you're a listener right now and you're wondering what your purpose is, do you have any exercises or tips to how to figure that out, so you don't have to wait till you're my age to,
right.
to have it revealed?
Well, I have a few thoughts on this. And again, there are many books you can buy on it. And I personally spent a whole period of time actually working with a purpose expert to get to my one sentence. But I don't think any of that is really necessary for the person who's just listening, who would like to maybe kind of, you know, narrow the scope of their understanding of why they're here. And so I call this sifting through your life story to find the breadcrumbs that point to your purpose. So one example that is excellent, I think, is, do you remember a time when you were usually a child, when somebody told you something about yourself was extraordinary that you just thought was ordinary? And I share my own brief story about, I came late to class as usual, and I burst in to Mr. Compensanto's math class, and I said, I'm late because, and he said, stop right there. I know you're famous for having a way with words, and you can convince anybody of anything, but it's not going to work with me. And all I heard was, famous for having a way with words. I mean, it was literally like the sea parted and somebody had
Thank you, Mr. Compensanto.
Because my whole life, I had always been told, if you'd only use your powers for good, you know? So that was a breadcrumb. You have an amazing way with words. And so that's one, is a time that somebody said to you, wow, you're so good at this. And you thought, oh, really? This is just the thing that I do.
Yeah. Okay. Hold that thought. We're going to come back with more breadcrumbs in a second.
Okay, perfect.
We were talking about following our breadcrumbs, those little things from our past that may lead us to some insight on purpose. And you were in mid-sentence about having a way with words.
Right. So that's one little thing to think about, a time that somebody told you were extraordinary at something you thought you were ordinary at. Another thing is, what are you doing when time flies? Like when 2 or 3 hours have gone up,
sex
gone by.
Sex doesn't count.
No, Lisa, okay. Sex does not count.
Shoot. Waka, waka.
So, you know, what is it you're doing when hours have flown by and you haven't looked at your clock once? Another thing is, what do people come to you for? Mm. You know, these are all breadcrumbs. And if you actually start looking at your motivations and your passions, you know, and your drives around these kind of stories, these breadcrumbs, you start seeing. And you know, you begin to put language around that. And then another thought, too, is like at your worst, at your most horrible moment, your crucible moment, what did you do next to get yourself out of it? Because a lot of times I think that's your truest voice is like, mm-hmm. you know, the God of the bathroom floor. You know, you're down. You just can't believe that you've been so devastated by whatever. And what was the next right thing that you did that got you sort of directionally correct? And a lot of times that is also a breadcrumb because, yeah, it's like kind of, it's almost like your soul kind of takes control in those situations. And I feel like another way of saying purpose is your soul's purpose.
Hmm. Interesting. Do you have either a breadcrumb from your past or a God of the bathroom floor?
That God of the bathroom floor, I mean, it's a tough story, and I feel like I carry this with me all the time. But when I became the editor-in-chief at one of the two different magazines that I led, we had to let a bunch of people go. And the magazine was just drifting in the wrong direction, and these people didn't have the right skills to set it straight. And so we did, you know, we sort of had one very, very bad day, probably my worst day. And, you know, I have to say it was god-awful. And then I gathered everybody together afterwards and sort of told them that they didn't have to carry that was my thing. And, you know, I think it was just a good instinct. And I was like, listen, we're not all going to come together as a team immediately. And this is hard.
Right.
And take some days. You know, I'm sorry that this is hard, but this is not your thing to carry around. It's mine.
Right. So what I would say about that is, again, knowing you as well as I do, is that naming the thing is something that you're excellent at. So, you know, you're feeling something and everybody's feeling it and nobody has the exact right thing to call it. And nobody knows how to put the scaffolding around it. That's language that makes everybody feel understood. And that's what you're amazing at. So I'm not surprised that in that incredibly devastating moment, you were able to stand up and name it and therefore like make the load lighter for everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. What's yours?
Oh, gosh. Well, the breadcrumb one. I was a sophomore in high school and I was class president and my report card came and literally this is on my report card, which is my quote unquote from the principal part of my permanent record.
And I'm just laughing because I have a joke with my children. There is no permanent record.
But they used to say that to us.
I know they used to say that like
and
it was
the most
damning
thing, right?
Totally.
Yeah. So it was literally the sentence. Lisa has remarkable leadership capabilities. Unfortunately, she has chosen to use them to lead people astray. And I think I've been doing that ever since.
I would focus on the remarkable leadership capabilities.
And the astray thing kind of was more intriguing to me.
Well, that's right.
Astray is where the fun is.
Yeah, exactly. You're the wild one. That's right. That is definitely a breadcrumb. Yeah, please, honey. I'll follow you astray anywhere.
You know what the story was? I'll tell you why she said that very briefly. We were in science class and my best friend and I had an idea that we would engulf the podium where the teacher was speaking in flames. So we had a pool of alcohol in front of his podium that had a little trail of alcohol back to our desk. So we wound it. This is how stupid we are. We wound it so he wouldn't know where that came from. And the alcohol dries, of course. So the trail up at the
pool. It wasn't gasoline.
Exactly. So the alcohol where he was standing didn't ever catch flame, but our desk did. So I was trying to put out the fire with my little mitts. You know, we had those Bunsen burners. So I'm putting out the fire with the mitts, and they're on fire. I don't want him to see it. So I throw them out the window. They land in the gutter with all these leaves and billows of smoke come through. I swear. So when I was caught doing that,
the accidental arsonist.
That's next level. That's epic.
That was bad.
Yeah, that's epic.
Yeah, that was just one of many events.
And I was the one that failed to distinguish myself.
Oh, I distinguished myself.
She went to Princeton, and I'm the one.
No. That was my daughter. I did not get into Princeton for that sort of reason.
I was the one that failed to distinguish myself. Never once started a fire. Not one single time.
Well, you know,
a person who really distinguishes themselves does a perfect trail of flames and really just blows up the teacher's desk.
All right, so question for you. Let's shift gears a little bit.
Okay.
I want to talk about rather than your emotional, spiritual, personal life, I want to talk about your professional life for a minute because so many people are going through, like Jill, professional U-turns. You are a woman in a decidedly male environment, and you are a powerful woman in a decidedly male environment. I can't imagine that is free of struggle, and you know, hopefully getting better today with the whole Me Too movement that we talked about. But can you just talk a little bit about what were your keys to success in a man's world?
Well, for one thing, I never saw myself as living in a man's world, even though obviously from the outside, it certainly looked like that. Only woman in the boardroom, only woman here. I just never saw it that way. And I think that honestly, authentic storytelling has been the reason because I tell authentic stories from my heart and the people that I'm interacting with receive them and return them back to me with their own authentic stories. So I've been lucky enough to build partnerships that felt kind of somewhat beyond gender. And I didn't really feel that I was living in a man's world. I just felt like I was living in a competitive world of entertainment. I didn't see it as gendered. Through the lens now of Me Too, I've certainly come to see certain experiences that I had that I thought were personal to me, to probably being more gender-oriented than I realized, particularly around some of this research that we're seeing now that when a woman speaks once in a meeting, the men in the room report that she spoke 3 to 4 times when she actually only spoke once. So I think probably I didn't factor in some of the baggage that I was carrying into the room that I wasn't even aware of. But for the most part, I just feel like, you know, I've always just focused on being impeccable in my steps and really just being in a constant pursuit of excellence. I never worry about who gets credit for anything. Whenever possible, I always try to make somebody else, you know, look good or pass the ball to somebody else. And so I just feel like I've had, from a corporate perspective, kind of a pretty blessed experience.
When you say that you kind of tell these authentic stories, I think you're just really rigorously honest and always, always have been. Have you had to pull that back, though, in the corporate world?
I haven't. Maybe I should have. I mean, and to be honest with you, maybe I should have been smarter. But, like, when I remember when I first came to William Morris, nobody wore jeans. I mean, it was just, like, 2000 or 2001, and literally jeans weren't, like, the thing that everybody wore.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I'm not going to come here and just start dressing like everybody else. I'm not going to wear what was then the black Prada, you know, business suit. Like, I'm just going to be me, and you guys aren't— the audience isn't looking at me, but I have tons of big curly hair. And I just thought, I can't straighten my hair and wear these business suits and be somebody that I'm not, because if I do, I won't be able to be my best. And I'm so focused on being impeccable in my steps that I just thought, it's almost like if you had to run a race, you wouldn't want to wear stilettos. Like, I have to win the race.
Right.
So I just kind of dispensed with all the things that I felt like could potentially hold me back. And I've just always felt intuitively that being myself is the best version of me that I have. And then at least then, if I don't get the job, or if I don't get the author, it was me that didn't, as opposed to me trying to be some version of what I think is acceptable in a corporate society.
Because that's when you hugely regret it.
Totally.
That's when you look back and you think, I said this.
I meant this.
And I meant this, and then I didn't get it. And you think, what would have happened if I had just put my, you know, gone with option A, which was my instinct.
Totally. And that's just been... that's been like a guiding light for me, because I feel like if I'm not uniquely qualified to do the job, then they don't need me. But if I am uniquely qualified to do it, then let me do it. And let me do it, you know, in the clothes that make me feel comfortable, using the language that makes me feel comfortable. And again, early on in the boardroom, I would say, well, the universe is saying, yeah. And people would look at me like I was bananas. And then, you know, when I was right about things, people would come up and say, well, what is the universe, you know, saying about this? You know,
if you wanted a universal prediction.
Exactly.
You've got a direct line to the universe.
Exactly. Or I would say, you know, if somebody says something to me in a heated business context, I would say, well, that actually hurts my feelings.
Mm.
And people would be really taken aback. And then eventually they got kind of used to it, and they began to, like, return that kind of language. And then it's a lot better having a conversation about hurt feelings than escalating every freaking conversation to values, where it's like, you know, who's a better person, which is, like, I think the way that it often happens in a corporate environment. And so, like, I just bring my whole self and I bring my whole heart. I don't have a separate personality. Like, I never understood that. People who have, like, a work personality. Oh, my God. People who have a sex personality. I was like, one personality is more than enough. It's all terrifying enough. Like, So I just use the one personality I have in every situation.
Yeah, works pretty well.
Easier to remember.
I like that one. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us, our great friend.
Love you guys so much, and I'm so excited that you're doing this together. I feel like you're going to help so many people with their U-turns.
Yes, and the Together Live conference, I can attest to the fact that it is a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Thank
you.
And you
can find Jennifer there. You can also find her on Instagram at Jennifer Walsh.
Yes, and come check us out at togetherlive.com and maybe join us this fall on the road.
Yeah.
Yay. And you can check us out at U-Turns Podcast. And tell us about your experience when you go to Together Live. Share your stories.